And we have with us live in the studios, once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover, starting with an election addendum.
Yeah, we were sitting around last weekend after the show and talking about endorsements. And I gave this sort of Luke Kuhl endorsement last week for Joe Malahan for Seattle mayor, the mayor being the most problematic race of the endorsements that are for the August 18th primary. And those Eat the State endorsements, by the way, are up at www.eatthestate.org. But there was one endorsement in particular, the mayoral endorsement of Joe Malahan, that just didn't sit right. I mean, it was a very, very sort of grudging endorsement. And but we were talking it over, and well, Mike McGinn, we really couldn't endorse him either, and certainly not James Donaldson, and certainly not Jan Drago, and certainly not Greg Nichols, and we just kept going down the list, and it kept getting worse and worse and worse. And
none of the candidates really looked all that good.
And it was like, you know, no matter who we vote for, the next mayor of Seattle isn't going to be very good. And so we suddenly realized, if you're going to have a bad mayor, why not go for the worst mayor?
Yeah, you know, if you're going to have bad, why not have perfectly bad?
So we decided to launch a write-in campaign, figuring that, you know, why go for the devil you don't know when you can vote for the devil you do know?
Yeah, or the devil that everybody knows.
Yes. And of course, he goes by many names, but we are, of course, referring to Satan. And, you know, we figure it's an easy name. People remember it as tremendous name ID.
Easy to write in.
Yeah, easy to write in.
Easy
he'll,
to spell.
He'll be able to publicize his campaign because, of course, he invented the robocall. And, you know, who better to oversee the deep bore tunnel? Who better to master the Seattle process? You know, who better to sell your soul to in a political campaign?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't sell your vote these days, but you can certainly sell your soul.
Yeah, so since Seattle is at a crossroads, we decided that we wanted to have a writing campaign for Satan for mayor.
And that's change you can believe in.
Change that will last, as a matter of fact.
For an eternity.
So
the devil you know.
Exactly. So write in SATAN for mayor in your August 18th primary.
Satan for Seattle, because we deserve each other.
Because we deserve each other, and you know, the consequences be damned.
All right. Well, moving on, still talking about related to the elections, some developments with Susan Hutchinson's campaign.
Yeah, speaking of satanic figures, Susan Hutchinson, of course, the former TV newsreader on Cairo TV and creationist who has ridden her dinosaur into the King County executive's race, but has been very coy and very not forthcoming about information on a number of things, particularly her stances on, well, any number of issues, but in particular her Neanderthalic views on a lot of social issues, but also on her history. Since she doesn't have any history as an elected official, she's been pointing to her experience, believe it or not, as a TV news anchor, but she, in fact, left Cairo TV after some 20 years on very unfriendly terms when she left that position, and filed suit against the station claiming age and race discrimination after the station replaced her in 2002 with a younger Asian American woman. That's right, she sued for race discrimination because she's white, and God knows that it's hard for white people to get roles on TV these days. But those court records, Hutchinson had been saying, were sealed so that she couldn't talk about the settlement of that suit, and she couldn't talk about the circumstances around her departure from the station or any of the aspects of her employment record and her employment experience at Cairo TV. Well, this week, in response to the request from a number of news organizations, the court unsealed some of those records, also Hutchinson is still refusing to talk about it, claiming that the court has sealed those records, even though a judge says, no, they're not sealed.
And released about half the papers to the Seattle Times for them to read the documents in the case.
Yeah. So the most interesting pieces of that were that Hutchinson was sacked for having the lowest ratings of any of the television newscasts in Seattle for the time periods that she was on. But in particular that she was suspended from Cairo over 1/4 of July holiday for calling in sick, and then after she had been denied vacation time over that weekend and then being spotted canoeing with her family in Oregon. Now Hutchison is hardly the first person to call in sick because you want to take a day from work, and she certainly wouldn't be the first person to lie about that, and it's really kind of hard to condemn that because at one point or another, I think just about everybody has done that. But what's really actually kind of disturbing about this is that she's lying to voters about it also. That she is saying, well, rather than saying something like, well, say, it's a very human thing. Everybody does it, and sometimes family is more important than work. Everyone would get that. But instead, she's claiming that, oh, the judge is still forbidding me from talking about this, and the judge who unsealed the records doesn't have the authority to say that I can't talk about it.
Well, she claims she signed a confidentiality agreement with Cairo, but representatives of Cairo have said on the record that she is free to discuss the lawsuit as long as she doesn't talk about the actual settlement amount.
Yes.
And so she's, in effect, been released from her confidentiality agreement, but she claims she hasn't been. So, in effect, she's really lying to voters right now.
Yeah, and again, the disturbing part of that is that, I mean, you know, who would sue her if she talked about her confidentiality agreement or bust her for it? The courts wouldn't. Cairo wouldn't because they've released her from it.
Right.
And so she's basically trying to have it both ways, saying, oh,
she's
Cairo,
hiding something. Yeah.
You know, Cairo picked on me. I'm the victim in this because I'm a white woman. And at the same time talking about how wrong she was, but she can't really talk about it, and she can't really respond to the allegations from the papers that have been released.
Yeah, and the Seattle Times have looked through those papers, and they've said that it appears that she had other problems going on at work as well. She had kind of a stormy relationship with her boss. She spent some time trying to undercut him with the other employees at the station, and that she sort of reacted to the atmosphere at work as if it was a terrible and sinful place to work because people there had extramarital affairs. Some may have been engaged in drug use, et cetera, et cetera.
So
it seems to me that her extreme right-wing conservative views put her at odds with her coworkers.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want people to know that.
And the tremendous egos that turn up in a profession like television news are not a surprise either. But again, do you really want an ego like that running the King County government?
I would not want her as a boss.
And do you want somebody like that whose views are totally at odds with the people around her, insisting that she gets her way all the time, which is also the case here? So she is a very problematic choice, and a lot of this is coming out in this lawsuit issue.
All right. Update regarding Referendum 71.
Yeah, Referendum 71, the initiative, referendum rather, where signatures were turned in by right-wing groups and churches, including, no doubt, Susan Hutchison's, that are seeking to repeal this the same-sex domestic partnership laws that were passed by the legislature this last legislative session. Those signatures are now being checked for validity and for certification by the Secretary of State's office, and it looks like it's going to be very, very close as to whether R-71 is going to be on the ballot this fall or not. Initially, the information being released by the Secretary of State's office and reported by local TV and newspapers suggested that it was going to make it. And they suggested this because the initial rejection rate for duplicate signatures was very low. But if you think about it in both mathematical or common sense terms for a moment, when you first have a very small sample size because you've just started counting and checking the signatures, the duplication rate is going to be low. As that number of checked ballots increases or checked signatures increases, you're going to find more and more duplicates and a much higher percentage of duplicates. Well, that's exactly what has happened. So I looked over the course of the the week, like R-71, would not in fact make it. And at the end of the day yesterday, the Secretary of State's office released another surprise, which is that there's a second stage in this process where a master checker goes back and reviews the rejected signatures for being duplicates or invalid, and has reversed the rulings on about 100 of those. So now it's being back to being too close to call. So we're probably going to find out sometime in the next week whether Referendum 71 is going to be on the fall ballot or not. It's going to be very, very close.
All right. Moving on, it looks like there might be a bus fare increase in our future.
Oh, yeah. You know, this is at the same time that opponents of the upcoming vote on the bag fee, who don't want the 20-cent plastic bag fee to go into effect in Seattle, all kind of... you know, they're kind of moaning about how, oh, this could be a terrible impact, this 20-cent bag fee on the poor. Well, at the same time, the King County Council is considering ways to close an upcoming budget hole for Metro Transit by raising bus fares 25 cents a year for the next 4 years. So that's a total of a dollar increase over 4 years. Julia Patterson, Reagan Dunn, Pete von Reichbauer, and Kathy Lambert were the four county council members who came up with this brilliant idea.
Yeah, Patterson's a Democrat, the rest are Republicans.
Yeah, and they all represent rural and suburban districts on the east side in South County. None of them are from constituents inside the city of Seattle, where ridership is the highest. King County Executive Kurt Triplett didn't want to set up a fight between the county council members that represent rural and suburban districts and the ones that represent the city of Seattle. And so he proposed what is his version of a compromise. He wants to increase fares 25 cents in 2010 and 11, so just by a total of 50 cents in the next 2 years. And he wants to cut service on equally on all routes by 9%. On every single route. I don't see how that's going to avoid a dust up between council members, because dang, you know, if you've got routes in the city of Seattle that are full 24/7, you get told by the county executive that he wants to cut those routes by 9%. That just doesn't make sense. And
it's a much more disproportionate impact than the routes that are a quarter full out in, you know, Maple Valley somewhere.
Yeah. I think a better proposal is some council members have proposed cutting the existing foot ferries to Vashon Island and West Seattle from downtown Seattle, that could help at least in the short term to plug some of the budget holes in Metro. Weirdly, one of the things that Triplett proposed was to preserve the 5 rapid ride lines that were approved in the Transit Now measure 3 years ago. But, you know, those rapid ride bus lines, those were approved as extras to add on to essential bus service. And they were approved during a time when we were going through a budget surplus and the economy was good. I would think those should be the first things cut, not the first things preserved. So folks should be contacting the county council, and I think you should be contacting in particular Dow Constantine and Larry Phillips and telling them to, hey, don't pay quite as, you know, pay a little less attention to your county executive campaigning and a little more attention to what your colleagues are doing on the county council.
All right. Moving on to a court ruling affecting our forests.
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, based in San Francisco, overturned this week the Bush administration's repeal of the ban that was put in place by Bill Clinton in his outgoing days as president on roads in roadless forests. Now, this obviously has been litigated for the last 8 years, and in the interim, a lot of logging was done under the Bush administration that probably shouldn't have been done. But ultimately, this is probably good news for the nation's roadless or formerly roadless forests. And I say probably because there's a similar case also pending in the more conservative Tenth Circuit. And if they rule the other way, this is something that could wind up being litigated further all the way up to the Supreme Court. But as it stands now, the Ninth Circuit has established the precedent. And so there's been a halt declared to those road building and hence logging activities, including some in the Pacific Northwest, across the country in roadless forests. And this is something that is supported by the Obama administration. So the federal government has done a 180 on this issue, as it did when there was the transition from Clinton to Bush.
All right. Well, that takes us on to national news and this week's economic news.
Yeah, the stimulus spending is stalled, according to the federal government. They released some statistics to the media showing that, for example, the federal government has spent only 1% of $1 billion that was allocated in the stimulus bill for building upgrades. The Federal Transit Administration has spent about $500 million of a total of $8.4 billion that it received from the stimulus package. And the Coast Guard hasn't spent any of $240 million they received. Caltrans, the California Transit Authority, has spent just a tiny fraction of some $2.6 billion it received, and on and on and on. And this is at a time when state and local governments have been struggling terribly. I mean, if you look at the Caltrans admitting that they've spent only a tiny fraction of $2.6 billion they've received, and then you look at the California state government, which has just had to plug an enormous budget hole by doing drastic things like cutting school services, then, you know, you have to scratch your head and say, okay, what was the whole stimulus package about? It was sold to the voters as the federal government has to go even deeper into debt to spend this money right now as soon as possible on projects that are ready to be worked on so that we can stimulate the economy.
And we can't spend much time debating it because time's a-wasting.
Time's a-wasting, and we got to fund those projects that are ready to be worked on right now. Well, as it turns out, most of those projects were not ready to be worked on right away, and most of them won't even get started until the fall of this year, right about the same time that the construction season ends. The seasonal construction season usually winds down in the fall to because you can't do a whole lot of building in the winter time. And now these agencies are saying, well, yeah, we expect to spend the bulk of the money next summer, about a year from now.
It'll help stimulate during the recession of 2010.
Yeah, I just thought folks ought to know that while King County Council is debating raising bus fares to plug a hole in the Metro Transit budget, money that could have gone to plug that hole is just sitting around in accounts waiting to be spent next year on some, you know, infrastructure upgrades.
Well, we assume it'll still be in those accounts next year and won't be transferred to something else.
Right, right.
And we assume the dollar will still have some value next year. We may be talking about it as money that was given to us in 2009 dollars.
Yes, yes, and who knows what of many scenarios could occur between now and then.
Plenty of time. Yep. All right. Other economic news?
Yeah, I want to talk about something that's been sold as stimulus that is working right now and probably is being hyped as the most effective stimulus that Congress is engaged in all year, and that's the Cash for Clunkers program. The House and Senate this week just tripled the funding for the Cash for Clunkers program for folks who aren't familiar.
And extended it to Labor Day.
Yeah, and extended. Well, they're hoping it will be extended to Labor Day, that there's enough money in there for that. Yeah, the Cash for Clunkers program is the program that offers, if you go to an auto dealership and fill out the right paperwork, turn in your old clunker that gets 18 or less miles per gallon, you could qualify for a rebate of $3,500 to $4,500 to get a new car that gets more than 22 miles per gallon.
That's 22 whole miles per gallon?
4 gallons more than your clunker.
On the freeway.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been one of the main criticisms.
I remember dating myself here, way back in the 1970s when cars got like 45 miles to the gallon.
Oh my God.
What happened?
Yeah, what happened? No, what happened was Detroit is what happened. Yeah. And there's been all kinds of stuff said about the Cash for Clunkers program. But in the end, you have to look at it and you have to ask yourself, what does it really do? Can we tell for sure if it is an economic stimulus? How do they know it's been the most successful economic stimulus that we've done all year? Well, the truth is, these people who are touting it as such don't know, because the program has paid out only a small number of rebates so far. We don't have the economic statistics for this month yet, so nobody really knows what the impact has been on the economy. So that's all hype when you hear people say, oh, this has been a wildly successful program, et cetera, et cetera.
Nor do we know the environmental impact.
Well, for the economy, we just the facts are not in yet. But what we do know is we can surmise that this is probably not a great program for the environment.
Yeah.
Because the savings in gas mileage is not that significant. Also, you have to take into account the fact that people are trading in and junking they're trading in these vehicles that need to be junked, and those things need to be disposed of somehow. And they're also it's been effective for
and
auto
junking
dealerships.
Cars in many cases that can still be used.
Yeah, and for many auto dealerships, sure, it's been great because they're moving inventory off the lots like crazy, and some are ordering new cars. That means that this creates more demand for manufacturing more cars, which draws more on the environment. That's what we know about the Cash for Clunkers program and its environmental effects. Another thing that we can surmise is that it's not going to be great for the finances for American families. People are going to be taking a car that may be fully paid for which the insurance is cheaper, for which the auto licensing fees are cheaper, and they're going to be trading it in for a new car for which they'll have to make car payments. They'll have to pay more in insurance and licensing. They'll have a whole bunch of expenses that they didn't have. And right now we do know that the bottom line is that most Americans are struggling economically, and to entice them into buying new cars just seems cruel.
Now, wait a minute. Let me see if I can get this straight. So the public policy right now is to entice people to go into debt to buy a shiny new thing, further debt, a shiny new thing that they can't really afford so as to stimulate the economy. Isn't that how we got in this mess in the first place?
Exactly. And only we did it with home ownership.
Houses.
Now it's time to do it with cars.
Awesome. God, is this a great country or what?
Two cars in every garage that you can't afford.
Well, yeah, three cars.
Garage? What garage?
Well, actually, that's where a lot of people are.
Well, you can live out of that new car.
Exactly.
And then, Congress looked at that and they said, well, Cash for Clunkers, that seems like a really good deal for these people. Let's get in on the act. So the House this week approved $550 million to buy 8 new jets so that congressional officials and other members of the federal government can travel more. Now, Congress and the federal government already have a fleet of about two dozen jets that are maintained by the Air Force. And the Pentagon was going to buy just two jets to replace old ones in the fleet, and then they were going to say, well, look, we've got two of the jets in our fleet we lease. Let's just buy them outright to save money on and not have to keep paying the lease fees and interest, et cetera. But the House got greedy, and they just decided to double that amount to 8 new jets. And I find this highly ironic that when the government is running up a record deficit, and when Congress excoriated all of these financial executives for flying on their private jets to attend congressional committee meetings, that Congress would then turn around and approve the purchase of 8 brand new jets, even, away, far and above what the Air Force said was needed to maintain routine travel for congressional members.
Yeah, but this wouldn't be their private jets. These would be owned by the people.
Oh, yeah, they would
just
be.
They'd just be using them exclusively.
But just
jets for porkers. I like it.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Okay, moving on to town halls held all across this country.
Yeah, speaking also of the Cash for Clunkers program, one of the big talking points the Republicans have been pushing about health care reform is that if the government can't even properly administer the Cash for Clunkers program, how could it possibly administer socialized medicine? Now there are a number of fairly obvious flaws with this, but the most problematic part of it is how this argument is being made, which is that a number of the AstroTurf groups, including one that is orchestrated by former House Leader Dick Armey, have devised this strategy of going to the town hall meetings that are being held by all legislators, but they're targeting the Democratic ones all across the country during the August recess, and literally disrupting them, trying to shout down the congresspeople, shout down the people that they disagree with in the audience, and basically try to incite a riot. And this has led to violence at a number of different town hall meetings all around the country, and the idea is to make this appear like this spontaneous outpouring of emotion from angry people who are just furious that the government is intruding on their right to health care from whatever doctor or whatever that they choose. Now, mind you, we haven't had that right in this country for any number of years, and quite frankly, I'd much rather have a government bureaucrat making healthcare decisions who at least theoretically has the interest of the public in mind than an insurance company bureaucrat who very definitely does not. But be that as it may, these are brown shirt tactics. These are tactics that are designed not to further discourse on a contentious subject, but to shout down and intimidate and insinuate violence against anybody who disagrees with you. And it's a very, very worrisome tactic.
Yeah, now I don't have any problem with people expressing their opinion. I've been in a number of demonstrations where the goal was to confront public figures at forums. But, you know, I've never been in one where the goal was to lynch an effigy of that person, to suggest that person should go and commit suicide or do any of a number of things, very violent things that some of these groups have done. I find that to be extremely disturbing. And as Jobs says, there are well-known, very conservative groups that may be taking money from the Republican Party, but definitely taking money from Republican donors who are
and
behind
insurance companies and healthcare companies.
Yes, who are behind organizing these events, and I find that really disturbing. It does to me look a lot like the run up to like World War II, things that happened when thuggish militias sort of clamped down on true democracy and communities, and that led to fascism ultimately in the end. I find this very disturbing.
All right, moving on finally to international and Afghanistan.
Yeah, we had not Afghanistan, Pakistan. We had an apparent assassination on Wednesday of Batullah Masood, who's the Al Qaeda leader in Pakistan.
The
architect, in all probability, of Benazir Bhutto's assassination, and the head of the Taliban in Pakistan. But what hasn't been reported very well, and the story into this morning's New York Times. Times emblematic about that is that he was killed while he was in a regional medical facility being treated for dialysis. The Times pussyfooted around this by saying he was being treated for a kidney ailment and that he was being treated on the roof of his brother-in-law's house or some such thing. Well, anybody who knows anything about dialysis, and Masood was in his mid-30s and suffering from a kidney ailment, that's exactly what I had at exactly the age that I had it. Even in Seattle, there are very few dialysis treatment centers. Certainly in rural Pakistan, there's going to be a lot fewer than that.
That was the only one in that region.
This was probably what is keeping thousands of people, or was keeping thousands of people alive in rural northwestern Pakistan.
Yeah.
And to attack a medical facility and to attack somebody getting treatment at a medical facility is a war crime. So there's a certain amount of comfort in knowing that if there was any doubt before that Barack Obama can now join every other post-World War II American president in being eligible for prosecution for war crimes.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is that they used an unmanned aerial drone to send a missile into the second floor of this medical treatment facility to kill Masood, his wife, his bodyguards, and presumably everybody else nearby.
Yeah, several other relatives.
Including
yeah.
other patients and medical personnel. That is against international law. In war, you cannot target hospitals and medical facilities. Doesn't matter who is being treated there. If the enemy is being treated there, it's the same as if it's your soldiers being or your civilians being treated there. You are not to target those places. And not only are we using weapons of mass destruction, we are also violating international law.
Yeah. Also in the news today, interestingly enough, is that the regional al-Qaeda leader in Indonesia, Nordin Muhammad Top, was reportedly shot and killed. And this also points up that the military strategy under the Obama administration, as with Bush before him, seems to be really fixating on these individual leaders of different cells of these organizations. When these organizations almost all have secession movements, they certainly would have, in the case base of the Taliban in Pakistan, where their leader was known to be seriously ill. So somebody else will just come up and replace them. It doesn't really have very much military value at all. We saw that with Zarqawi in Iraq in 2006, and we'll see it again this year.
And when you assassinate their leader, the next guy to step into his shoes is probably going to be more radical.
And more pissed off.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is put out every couple of weeks, 3 weeks during the summer, to bookstores and cafes and other places where you find free periodicals. The current issue has the election endorsements in it. Don't forget Satan for mayor, and don't forget to send in your ballot before October, before
August
18th. Satan for mayor, write it in. You can also find it on the web, and you can find those endorsements on the web also at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer for the Satan for Mayor campaign, give our voicemail a ring. It's area code 206-719-6947. And being the Satan for Mayor campaign, you will definitely get voicemail.
Don't we already have Satan for Mayor?
And Maria, you have a new blog out.
I do have a new blog out. You can find it at www.mariatomchik.blogspot.com.
Congratulations.
Thank you.